I next met with Dr. Corey Langer, and to begin, I asked him about a 64-year-old patient from his practice.
64-year-old, previously healthy, never smoker, mild cough, presented about a year ago. She was diffident, but someone suggested getting an x-ray, and lo and behold, there was a vague shadow in the right upper lobe. Her exam was completely normal. She underwent a CAT scan, which showed a fairly central 3.5 centimeter right upper lobe mass that seemed to be kissing, if not invading, the mediastinum. It also showed a somewhat juicy 2 centimeter pretracheal lymph node. Of course, the latter was not evident on the plain film. So she underwent a bronchoscopy and a bronchial ultrasound, which confirmed adenocarcinoma in the N2 node. Special stains were positive for TTF1. And she underwent the standard workup for anybody with putative locally advanced non-small cell. She had a PET scan, which fortunately showed no evidence of extrathoracic tumor, and a brain MRI was negative. And you could argue that's all the workup you need, but inevitably in this day and age, we're frequently, though not always, doing PD-L1 testing and molecular testing. And in fact, her PD-L1 came back completely negative. And her molecular markers, unsurprisingly, since she was a never smoker, proved positive for EGFR mutation. It was actually not one of the standard ones. It was atypical but still actionable mutation, exon 18. And all other markers were negative, including TMB and MSI. They were either negative or low.
Just to clarify for our audience, TMB and MSI?
TMB is tumor mutation burden, certainly in advanced disease. Higher mutation burden is associated with greater sensitivity to checkpoint inhibitors, particularly the combination of ipi-nivo. Its implications in locally advanced are completely unclear. And of course, very recently, Pembro has a standalone indication that's disease agnostic, but based on microsatellite instability. So genomic instability, which is a bit more common, colorectal cancer, but in fact can be seen in just about any malignancy.
Just out of curiosity, not to get too far off, but I've heard people say that MSI testing now should be done in anyone with a metastatic solid tumor. I've heard other people say anybody with metastatic adenocarcinoma. What's sort of Penn's policy about that?
Definitely metastatic adenocarcinoma. I think it's still relatively rare in squamous. So you can make a blanket statement that except for PD-L1 testing, there's not a good strong indication to do molecular testing in squamous. Though if you get a never smoker or a remote former smoker, regardless of histology, I would still do full molecular testing. And most of the send out reports, there are many companies that are doing this now, will include MSI as part of their assays.
So you start her on concurrent chemo radiation therapy. Which regimen do you utilize?
I used a tried and true one I've been using now for over 20 years, actually probably closer to 25 years, weekly paclitaxel and carbo. She was offered enrollment in a phase 3 trial comparing photon beam, standard radiation, to proton beam, but declined that. There were some logistical issues that precluded her going on that trial. And she finished a full course. She got 66 gray. We can argue whether 60 gray is the standard or whether we should go higher. Certainly pushing the doses up to 74 gray or higher, it's not panned out. We had a major phase 3 study, 0617, that actually showed a survival decrement with higher doses using conventional photon radiation. And she had a modest response. I wouldn't call it a PR, but at least some shrinkage. The node clearly shrank. There was no other signs of tumor, certainly no evidence of disease progression.
So before you go on, I'm kind of curious, I don't know whether she asked you this question, but if she had, or if a patient were to ask you who had this clinical situation, at the completion of the chemo radiation that she had, what would be your estimate for the chance that she's going to have recurrent disease in the future?
So up until Pacific, I would have guesstimated somewhere between a 65 and 75% chance of having a recurrence, either local, regionally, or distantly. And the brain is often a sanctuary site, which is rather unfortunate. We'll discuss Pacific a little bit more, but those numbers have improved, clearly, at least broadly. Now, she's probably in a better prognostic group. She's female. She's a never smoker. Her tumor burden, not mutation burden, but actual tumor burden, is relatively low. She's got a smaller primary and a single apparent node, and she's tolerated treatment. So the numbers I quoted are really the broad numbers, but I would be a bit more optimistic about her chances.
And just out of curiosity, what would you estimate her risk is if she were able to receive durvalumab, assuming she was, let's say, a typical patient?
Well, that is a big debate, and that was actually a dilemma we wrestled with. There was no PD-L1 positivity. She did have an EGFR mutation. And you actually analyzed the second publication of PACIFIC. That group, the group that did not have PD-L1 expression, did not seem to have a survival benefit. In fact, the hazard ratio was in the wrong direction. It was about 1.3, although the confidence intervals were overlapping unity. So on the face of it, one could perhaps make an argument that this could be deleterious. It may not be advisable. But got to remember, this was a post hoc exploratory analysis. The overall trial had well over 700 patients. The group that had zero expression, it was a small minority. It was probably about 150, 160 overall. And well over 40% of patients did not have testing for PD-L1. So I'm not sure I'm going to hang my hat on that. And at least the overall study was, frankly, astoundingly positive, both for PFS and OS. So we actually had this conversation. This individual is extremely well informed. She certainly knew her way around medical articles. And we had a frank debate. Folks in this day and age would call it shared decision making. And we mutually opted to proceed. I'd have to state flat out that in people with the PD-L1 positive tumors, I embrace PACIFIC with enthusiasm. And those who are negative, there's certainly a degree of ambivalence.
So in the majority of patients who do have some PD-L1 expression, if you just sort of look at it globally, and let's just put aside the EGFR mutation for a second, you said that globally you're looking at 65-75% risk of relapse, maybe a little bit less in this lady. How much do you see, would you estimate, did you tell her, you think that would decrease?
For all comers, at least on PACIFIC, it's about a 10-11% absolute improvement in survival. At least at 2 years now, we do have maturing data, and we have a 2-year survival rate of about 66% versus 55%. And it should be noted that the majority of recurrences in locally advanced usually occur in the first 2 to 3 years. So I'm sure the overall survival will be a lot less than 66%. But we're talking a reasonable chance of 40%, 50%. I mean, these are unprecedented numbers. It could be lower, but at least the trajectory of the curves looks fairly promising.
I guess the other kind of way to look at data in these kinds of situations, in addition to absolute changes, as relative risk reduction. What globally in your own mind you visualize as a relative risk reduction and risk for recurrence and death?
So I think at least the metric I use now in locally advanced and frankly in advanced disease, I want to see a maximum hazard ratio of 0.75, 0.80, and the PACIFIC data at least fall within that range. The PFS data are a bit more impressive, but ultimately at the end of the day, it's the OS data that'll, I think, govern usage. We've gone 25, 30 years without a single positive trial in locally advanced non-small cell. And it's not for lack of trying. And here, in one fell swoop, we have a strikingly positive trial. And I have to admit that I was one of the skeptics.
No, I remember when it first came out and you were saying, wow, that's a big bump in, you know, progression-free survival, but let's, you know, hold out and see what survival. But seemed like a lot of people, even you, I think, jumped on board even before you saw the survival data because it was such a dramatic impact on relapse.
Not quite with the enthusiasm that some of my colleagues had. I mean, some immediately jumped on board as soon as the study came out, and certainly when the approval came out, I was a little bit more hesitant, although I have to confess, probably offered it to the majority of folks who are eligible for durvalumab even before the survival data came out. But there was still that element of doubt. I don't know if you want me to go through it, but there are still a lot of criticisms for this trial.
Before we get off into that, let's just finish out with her case, because there are a couple other things I wanted to bring up about her specifically before we get into sort of the paper. So one other question I was thinking about is, in general, up until now or up until this came out, were you giving post-chemo radiation consolidation? Because you give paclitaxel carboplatin. Do you give it afterwards?
Yes, I did. I generally gave 2 cycles of pac carbo, either every 3 weeks or what I call the Bolani regimen, weekly, days 1 and 8, 15 every month for 2 cycles. And that had really become my standard probably for the past 15, 18 years.
So, but in this lady, did you give her that before she started their durvalumab?
No, I did not. the clinical trial at least stipulated the initiation of the checkpoint inhibitor within 2 to 6 weeks of completion of the chemo radiation without concurrent chemo. And since the study construct, that schema actually generated the data we've observed in the two New England Journal papers, I felt fairly strongly I wasn't going to deviate from the way it was given.
So this patient, another issue that this patient had an activating tumor mutation, EGFR mutation, and there's been debate about whether checkpoint inhibitors are helpful in patients with these mutations. But this was one trial, the Pacific trial, where they actually looked at that and it kind of looked like those patients benefited. Was that your take?
The numbers are really tiny. You go back to the original paper, it was about 42, 45 patients out of well over 700. Maybe a slight trend toward benefit. The confidence intervals were really wide, so they overlapped unity. And you have to go to the second paper and to the supplements to actually find the survival outcomes for the EGFR mutants. And they don't even have a forest plot. The numbers are way too small. So I think we're in uncharted territory. And again, for the same reason that I'd argue to at least consider durvalumab and PD-L1 negative, I'd make the same argument in this setting, at least for EGFR mutant. I am absolutely certain had this patient had metastatic disease, I would not offer a PD-L1 inhibitor, even if the PD-L1 had been positive in the face of an EGFR activating mutation.
Right. And there, I think people are using targeted therapy before even thinking about a checkpoint inhibitor.
Absolutely.
Another aspect of this in terms of the EGFR tumor mutation is, I believe that at one point, there was an intergroup trial looking at patients with locally advanced disease with activating tumors mutations and using targeted therapy before chemo radiation to sort of shrink it down. And I always thought that was a great idea, but I guess the trial ended.
Died. Lack of accrual. We think that mutations, or at least molecular aberrancies, are perhaps a little bit less common in earlier stage disease and locally advanced, and that trial simply did not accrue. It was the Alliance trial. It was both Alliance and the then RTOG, now Energy Group, together comparing erlotinib to placebo for 3 months followed by definitive treatment. Actually, it was erlotinib followed by definitive treatment versus definitive treatment. And for the ALK-positive group, a similar design of crizotinib followed by definitive treatment versus standard definitive treatment. And there was just no saving that trial. I had problems with that trial. I think the design sounds wonderful, but the TKIs only work as long as you give them. And 3 months may be insufficient. And for that matter, I have difficulty with the ongoing adjuvant trials, which restrict its use to 2 years. We know that in one of the trials done in resectable disease, the SELECT trial, as soon as they stopped the treatment at 2 years, there was a sudden drop in progression-free survival. So I'm worried about the use of TKIs in this setting. And at least for the majority of patients with locally advanced non-small cell, probably 70 to 80% have no activating mutation. And they're the only agent that's been proven to benefit as a checkpoint inhibitor, in this case, durvalumab.
So I don't want to get too far off on this, but what about a patient who has bulky disease, the idea of maybe shrinking it down short term before chemo radiation? Is that something you ever do?
Not typically. There have been studies in the pre-checkpoint era where we compared induction therapy followed by concurrent versus concurrent up front and really didn't show any added benefit. Plus, you're delaying the definitive curative modality, which is still the radiation or chemoradiation combination. I will do it in select patients if the radiation oncologist tells me the field is just too big and they're going to cause major toxicity and I really need a debulking. Then we'll certainly initiate it. And then in certain frail patients who may not be up to concurrent chemo radiation, we may choose that approach, either chemo first, followed by radiation, or if they are in better shape at that point, concurrent chemo radiation.
And I guess also, as long as you brought it up, we should just briefly touch on where we are with adjuvant use of TKIs in these people with targetable lesions. You referred to that. And I guess I know the trials are out there, either in the adjuvant, you know, early the setting or even in the locally advanced setting. And I guess the one thing that you were mentioning about, you know, maybe the need of using long-term therapy is that it seems like now that you have osimertinib out there, that's going to be a lot more achievable than it was with the prior generation of TKIs in terms of tolerability. Is that your take, that most patients will be able to get through long-term osimertinib a couple years, maybe even more?
I think so, but ironically, the ongoing, at least cooperative group, prospective randomized phase 3 trial, the Alchemist trial, is using the older generation of drugs. They were initiated in another era, so erlotinib versus placebo, now observation for up to 2 years in the EGFR mutants, and then crizotinib initially versus placebo, now observation for up to 2 years in the ALK positive. I think if we had redesigned those studies now, it would be osimertinib versus observation, and of course, alectinib for the ALK positive group. There are separate prospective trials that are assessing osimertinib in the EGFR mutant in the adjuvant setting. And all of these trials, I believe, call for a minimum of 2 years of treatment.
Another question I have is you described, you know, what happened in terms of how this patient was worked up and managed, particularly diagnostically. I'm kind of curious what your take is as you see patients coming in who've been managed elsewhere for second opinions, whether there are any, let's say, myths, misperceptions, or things that people are doing out there, whether it's in the community or not, surgeons, radoncs, that maybe are different from what you do.
Well, I think there's a tendency to err on the side of molecular testing, even though we haven't proven in resectable or locally advanced disease that the institution of any of the TKIs really makes a difference in terms of survival. I consider it a research question. I certainly wouldn't fault someone for testing. It's good to know those answers in case the patient relapses, and then you know what to do at that point. I still see this tendency, two problems. Number one, to assume that if a node's present, it's positive. We've seen plenty of patients where there appears to be a fairly juicy node on CAT scan, even positive node on PET. We biopsy it, and it's completely negative. It's infiltrated with lymphocytes. You should not deny the patient an opportunity for resection, for curative resection, simply on the basis of a CAT scan or PET. The pathologic workup is absolutely essential. And then the second issue that comes up, a patient has locally advanced disease, they start chemoradiation, and a multidisciplinary conference convenes and they decide, well, let's see what happens at 45 gray. Have they responded sufficiently? Maybe we can consider surgery. That decision needs to be made up front. If it's going to be trimodality, you should know that a priori before you initiate the combined modality approach and not make that decision midway through the treatment. If you interrupt chemoradiation for any amount of time, a week, 2 weeks, you are reducing that patient's survival chances.
So I want to get your take on the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in locally advanced disease. But one other question again about this patient. I was intrigued by the fact that she was offered a trial of proton versus photon therapy. That's really interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about the trial and also what your take is on proton therapy in lung cancer?
Well, I think protons certainly have a potential role, particularly for larger central tumors. Remember, this is a way of really regulating the radiation dose within tissue depth. When you're using standard photons, you get the same dose through and through. The same dose that hits the skin, hits adjacent normal lung, hits the tumor, and then hits adjacent lung going back out. Whereas with protons, you can regulate that dose. You can actually concentrate that dose at the level of the tumor and then have an abrupt drop-off. So at least in theory, protons can limit or reduce the collateral damage that happens to adjacent normal tissue. And there are two upshots of that. Number one, potentially less toxicity. In selected patients, and this doesn't really apply here, you can envision folks with smaller tumors where you really may be able to increase the radiation dose safely beyond standard doses, beyond 60 or 66 gray. So this particular study is a head-to-head comparison. It was initiated through the then RTOG, now Energy Cooperative Group. The only comparison is the nature of the radiation. It's the same chemo. All these folks have unresectable, locally advanced disease, and I believe the doses are more or less the same. So it's a true comparison of different technologies. And with all the hype that proton therapy gets, you would think, oh my goodness, it must be better. It has to be better. But we have no proof, at least in locally advanced disease. We have yet to actually show prospective randomized data that documents an enhanced outcome with protons. And I think for that reason, this trial is critically necessary.
So I'm guessing you have access to proton therapy off trial.
Correct.
So I'm kind of curious, I heard the story about this patient, you know, she's the travel issue, but I'm kind of curious how people respond to that randomization. I'm going to guess a lot of people would rather just get treated with protons.
Or their insurance denies it and they get photons. It's a very tough trial to accrue, unfortunately. And I personally have equipoise. As a medical oncologist, I don't really have a preferred approach. And I think the question is important enough that it needs to be addressed in a phase 3 trial. Remember, we're talking about very expensive technology that requires cyclotron, it requires equipment that's not standardly available.
Yeah, and update me on that in terms of the amount of space that the current proton, you know, setups have. I know initially they were big spaces. Is that still the case?
I believe it's either 2 or 3 football fields to have sufficient space for the cyclotron. Now, fortunately, where I work at the University of Pennsylvania, the setting is above the former footprint of the Philadelphia Convention Center. And that area was big enough to accommodate this. The one downside, it's very close to a river, the Schuylkill River. And unfortunately, if it rains heavily and there's flooding, there's a real risk that this entire complex, which of course is underground, could get flooded. So it's a little bit unusual. Many proton centers are actually remote from the main cancer centers. The patients have to travel back and forth. Ours is explicitly on site. The patients just go up an elevator to get their chemo.
I thought that now they're moving towards smaller spaces being required, but I don't know too much about that.
Apparently, yes, but I don't know enough about the more recent technology to comment on it intelligently. But at least traditionally, it was a huge amount of space.
Right now, if the patient has insurance, in what situations do you encourage them to do? Is it a different experience for them? Do they get the same time?
Not really. A little bit more set up and time, but the actual treatments don't take that much longer. So from the patient perspective, it feels very similar.
Are there any clinical situations where you say, hey, you know, if your insurance covers this, maybe we ought to do this?
We frequently end up doing that. And we have a separate in-house study to accommodate those patients who, frankly, decline going on the randomized trial.
That's interesting. So let's get into this issue of checkpoint inhibitors in terms of locally advanced disease, what we know about it, not just the PACIFIC trial, but other agents that are being looked at, other trials that are being looked at. Maybe you can begin, though. I was interested in some of the sort of background for this whole idea of using checkpoint inhibitors near or close to radiation therapy. I was talking with Dr. Rimner about the old abscopal effect and whether that's for real. But can you talk from your own point of view about sort of the rationale for this kind of strategy?
Well, I think there's at least 2 to 3 rationales. Number one, we can see upregulation of PD-L1, which is the target of the checkpoints, particularly the interaction between T cells and tumor. So at least in theory, it can potentiate the capacity of the checkpoints to fight tumors. We also see release of tumor antigen and inflammatory cytokines with any sort of radiation. For that matter, you see that with chemo as well, and that in turn will stimulate the immune system. So on a very simple level, there's potential synergy between radiation, chemo, and the checkpoint inhibitors. And certainly that has been borne out in advanced disease, where we have several studies now in treatment-naive non-small cell, both squamous and non-squamous, showing a survival benefit for checkpoint inhibitors plus platinum-based chemo versus chemo alone. So whether or not we believe this is going to happen, at least clinically, prospectively, level one data shows that it's in fact translated into a survival benefit.
So as these trials were getting underway, I know another major issue was the issue of toxicity, tolerability, and specifically in lung cancer and specifically in patients who might have coexisting comorbidities, the question of whether there was going to be pneumonitis. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, what the, you know, sort of the baseline is in terms of what you see when you use chemoradiation, including in older patients, in terms of risk of pneumonitis and the time period that it rolls out over?
So usually pneumonitis, if it's going to occur, will be anywhere from 6 weeks to about 6 months after the conclusion of the chemoradiation. So it's not an immediate side effect the way esophagitis is. Esophagitis typically occurs 3, 4, 5 weeks into treatment. It peaks at the end of treatment and then improves over the ensuing month. This is a delayed issue. Pneumonitis is actually fairly common, but grade 3 is not. So grade 1 or higher rates are 20, 30, 40%, but grade 3 or higher is usually single digits. And I think one of the amazing and frankly unexpected observations from the PACIFIC trial was that there was virtually no increase in pneumonitis. It was about 4.5% overall. There's a separate prospective phase 2 trial of pembrolizumab in the same setting where the grade 3 and higher pneumonitis rate was 6.5%. It was maybe marginally higher, but I would still argue at acceptable levels. You got to remember, though, that to get onto these trials, patients had to have gone through the chemo radiation. They had to be fit enough. Certainly, if they had active pneumonitis at the time they're being assessed, they probably were not enrolled. So some of this may be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Anything else that maybe we can talk a little bit about the data that's out there, beginning with the PACIFIC trial? If you could just kind of provide a broad overview of what you think the key points were in the design of the trial, and then go through the key points in terms of the results.
So PACIFIC was a 2-to-1 randomization post definitive chemo radiation of durvalumab for up to a year versus placebo. Patients had to have locally advanced disease. They had to have gotten at least 2 cycles of a platinum-based chemo regimen, fairly low minimum dose of radiation. I think most of us would, at a minimum, give 60 gray. In this particular trial, it was 50 or 54 gray. So some would argue that perhaps the chemo radiation was, in some cases, suboptimal. But it was a slice of clinical reality. It was a global trial, and it really tried to accommodate clinical treatment as it existed throughout the world. The results were, to be blunt, were fairly shocking. It was a 3-fold increase in progression-free survival. The control arm was 5.6 months, and the investigational arm, the durvalumab arm, was 16.8 months. So you do the math, that's unprecedented. We've not seen that before in locally advanced disease. And when you looked at sites of progression across the board, whether it was lung, extracranial, metastatic sites, or brain for that matter, it was about a 40 to 50% reduction in the incidence of recurrence or metastases. So many folks, based on that, assumed that survival would be better. And I sort of thought it would be, but I hadn't seen the data yet. But the presentation in October of 2018 by Scott Antony, I think, put all doubt to rest. And in fact, there was this major PFS benefit translated into an overall survival benefit of about 10 or 11% absolute increase at 2 years with a clear-cut significant p-value. There's still some flaws to the trial. The trial did not mandate PET imaging at the get-go. In North America, at least, PET is a standard part of the workup. PETs are used as part of simulations. And we know that when we do a PET, even in patients who ostensibly have locally advanced disease, 10, 15, 20% of these patients will have otherwise occult metastases that are detected by PET. So those folks actually got onto the trial. And think about it. 2/3 of those folks got durva and 1/3 got placebo. Of course, the checkpoint's going to do better than nothing. So I was concerned that that might have helped contribute to the survival advantage. And to this date, we have no data on the percentage that it had PET at baseline, simply because that wasn't collected as part of the case report forms. The other issue is the control arm probably underperformed historic controls. The median PFS was 5.6 months. The only comparable trial was the vaccine trial called the START trial, where the PFS and the placebo control arm was about eight and a half months. So not a major difference, but still some difference. Nevertheless, the data certainly stand, and it's completely changed our therapeutic approach in locally advanced disease. In North America, it's approved across the board, regardless of PD-L1 levels. But intriguingly, in the EU, the approval is restricted to PD-L1 positive, 1% or higher. I think that's partly born out of a need to contain cost.
What about other toxicity? I should mention, I guess, your patient elected to be treated, and she's currently being treated. She's at 9 cycles, or where is she now?
At least when I last saw her, which was about 2 months ago, she's roughly about halfway through treatment, tolerating it extraordinarily well.
And what other issues arise in this setting and other settings when you give checkpoint inhibitors? What are some of the common toxicity issues? And what types of screening do you do? Do you do thyroid tests preventively? How do you approach monitoring for toxicity?
You basically, take an organ and add itis, and you can get any toxicity that's caused by these checkpoint inhibitors. Obviously, the biggest concern in the setting of locally advanced disease where radiation's been used to the chest is pneumonitis. But those rates have been a lot lower, as I mentioned, than we anticipated. But you still need to be on the lookout for other inflammatory sequelae. And I routinely check thyroid functions pretty much every time I get a scan, so at least every 3 to 4 cycles. Sometimes I just do it every cycle just so I don't forget to do it. It's not difficult. The TSH is an easy test to add to the general blood work. And I would guesstimate, in my experience, and this isn't specific to Durva, but to checkpoint inhibitors in general, I'm seeing about at least 15 to 20% incidence of hypothyroidism, predominantly hypothyroidism, one case of hyperthyroidism. We see adrenal insufficiency, so when a patient develops unexpected fatigue or lassitude, it's important to do a cortisone stimulation test. And we sometimes see hypogonadism. Any part of the pituitary adrenal axis can be affected. And I've had some patients, men in particular, have astoundingly low testosterone levels. And that's very easy to remedy. And it's not just a matter of libido or virility. These folks are extremely fatigued. So all of these hypothyroidism, hypoadrenalism, hypogonadism can translate into just general nonspecific symptoms of lassitude. I've seen other oddball toxicity. I've seen uveitis. I've seen nephritis. So again, simple history and basic lab work will detect these problems.
Can you imagine the number of people I've interviewed about checkpoint inhibitors the last few years? And I've never heard anybody say hypogonadism. Never heard
it. Let me be the first.
That is really amazing. Wow.
You look for it, you'll find it. Again, how often is it definitely due to the checkpoint inhibitors? If you don't have baseline, you don't know, but I've detected it.
Well, also something
it's
very...
It's documented. It's definitely documented.
I mean, something very treatable.
Absolutely.
And yet, never heard it. So, wow, that is fascinating. Very interesting. So this patient, nothing whatsoever, zero, no toxicity, nothing whatsoever.
Remarkably well, very pleased, very gratified. Her scans continue to show evolution radiation change. It's unclear if she has any viable tumor at this point.
I was going to ask you whether in a completely asymptomatic patient, there are any things that you can see on imaging in the lung that would get you to not start durvalumab, you know, from the radiation therapy. My understanding is you kind of always see something. Is there anything that in an asymptomatic patient would have you sort of turn back?
I think if the patient starts out before treatment, before the chemo radiation with pre-existing interstitial lung disease, that's the kind of patient I'd have second thoughts about enrolling, either on the clinical trial or using durvalumab empirically. So you really need to look at the initial entry criteria in the PACIFIC trial and see who is allowed on. I'm a little bit less strict about folks with prior autoimmune disease. If they had a remote history of, say, rheumatoid arthritis or Crohn's disease, again, we'll have the same shared decision-making discussion. For the most part, I've plunged ahead.
As long as you're bringing that up, what about people with prior transplants, for example, renal transplants?
Definitely not heart or liver. You only got one of those. Kidneys, again, a discussion. I have done it once. You run the risk of rejecting the allograft, but at least with kidneys, you can go to dialysis. You can't easily get a new heart or liver.
And of course, I think it's really a lot different, though, in the metastatic than locally advanced setting where, you know, have some people are going to be cured without any, you know, just with chemo radiation. But
my threshold would definitely be higher in locally advanced. I think I would hold off probably and just revert to my standard treatment.
So you referred to the Pembro single arm initiative. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that. What do we know about Pembro right now?
We know that it behaves very similarly to durvalumab. Who's your oncology group trial that took folks that were enrolled, the same sorts of patients that were enrolled on Pacific, completed chemo radiation and gave them essentially a year's worth of Pembro in the same setting. Here, I think ultimately they will be able to generate some pre-existing PET data since the trial was done in North America, though that's not yet been forthcoming. But the final outcomes are remarkably similar. Only about 40% of patients were able to complete the full year. So that's an important point, both in the Pacific trial and in the Hoosier Oncology Group trial. The majority of folks did not make it the full year. The median number of cycles, I believe, in the Hoosier Oncology Group trial was about 13, so about 9 months total. Response rates, there was an incremental response rate in both the Pacific trial and in the HOG trial, the Hoosier Oncology Group trial.
Well, there's no incremental because there was no comparison in the Hoosier group comparing to historical.
That's true, but in Pacific there was, and clearly the response rate continued or further response was higher in the Durva arm, and it seemed to match the data for Durva. Progression-free survival, again, was in the 15-16-month range, so pretty close to what was seen in Pacific. And 1 and 2 year survival numbers, almost identical. So it remains to be seen. I personally don't think one checkpoint inhibitor is necessarily going to be better than any other in this setting. I think the crucial question that we're asking at Penn and Robert Wood Johnson in Ohio and the folks at MD Anderson are asking is, can you give it concurrently with chemoradiation, then follow as consolidation? We have data that shows at least so far it's safe. We don't have any long-term efficacy data. And the folks at MD Anderson have looked at atezo in the same setting and, again, have shown relative safety, no obvious major increase in pulmonary toxicity, and 1 and 2 year survival rates that are at least as good, maybe a tad better than we've seen with the Pacific trial. But it's going to take a phase 3 trial to truly define the role of concurrent checkpoint inhibitors and chemoradiation. But it's an embarrassment of riches, but you know what? It's better to have more choices and
absolutely,
options.
Absolutely, absolutely. Is there a phase 3 trial of Pembro or one of the other things cooking, or we're going to be with durvalumab data for a while?
I think we're going to be with durvalumab for a while, but there are several trials cooking, so stay tuned. The problem is it's going to take a while for these trials to read out. So at least for the foreseeable future, at least I would guess for the next year or two through into 2020, durv is going to be the standard.
So I want to get into some of your other cases, but one other toxicity issue I was just curious about, because I've heard that a fair number of people on checkpoint inhibitors have dermatologic problems, supposedly low grade. Did this woman have any dermatologic problems, and what do you see?
She's escaped dermatologic problems, but I do see a fair amount of rash, usually torso, sometimes face, probably about 20-25%, generally low grade, treatable with topical steroids or with Benadryl. A fair number of folks get diffuse pruritus without rash. So again, one of the itises. So basically probably a symptom of very dry skin. The rash is a bit different from what we've seen with tyrosine kinase inhibitors. It's not the classical acneiform rash. We don't see onychomycosis, digital fissuring, and it usually dissipates over time.
So let's go through some of your other cases, sort of variations of this theme. I was curious whether you had many patients, because I'd heard that you see on occasion older, frail patients that really aren't chemo candidates, but you want to try to palliate them with radiation therapy. I asked if you had any patients. You said not many, but you came up with this 86-year-old man. What about him?
So this was a fellow who was clearly too frail for concurrent chemoradiation. And it's always a bit of a dilemma how to address these folks. He was a former heavy smoker, and I mean a really heavy smoker, 3 packs per day for over 60 years. You do the math, it's 180 pack years. Many comorbidities, as you'd expect with somebody who smoked that much. Coronary artery disease, he had a defibrillator. He had low-grade renal insufficiency with a creat of about 2, 2.5. Pretty severe COPD. Presented with cough and shortness of breath and a transient episode of hemoptysis. And initially, his primary doctors just thought it was a COPD exacerbation. But he ended up on x-ray having a fairly large left upper lobe mass. And you can imagine this type of patient. They arrive in clinic. They're in a wheelchair. They're on oxygen. He was just on 2 liters. They're unable to get up on the exam table. You have to do sort of a wheelchair exam. That sort of patient is not a candidate for combined modality therapy. Diffuse wheezing and bronchitis. Generously, he was a PS2. He was probably closer to a PS3. So big mass, 7 centimeters invading the left main stem bronchus. He was able to tolerate a bronchiebus, although even that was questionable, and that showed squamous cell. And of course, the procedure itself was complicated. He ended up having transient respiratory insufficiency. He had to go to the ICU. He required a non-rebreather for about 48 hours and then high flow O2, and he was ultimately discharged on a higher rate of oxygen flow on 4 liters. So even the diagnostic workup in this population can be hazardous. So the question was what to do. He was having symptoms. He was clearly more short of breath from this mass. It was invading the main stem bronchus, so it was causing hemoptysis. So he got essentially a palliative course of radiation, 30 gray and 10 fracs, about a 2-week course. And a month later, he improved. He was back down to 2 liters. His shortness of breath was better. The hemoptysis had died down. Basically, we returned him to his pre-diagnostic baseline, which was still all his comorbidities. And the mass had shrunk, hadn't disappeared, but it was down to about 3 to 4 centimeters. And we looked back, and lo and behold, his PD-L1 was positive at 80%.
80%?
Yeah.
What's his current situation?
So the question was whether to watch and wait or start Pembro. Even though he did not have metastatic disease, I had no delusions that we had given him curative therapy. We have not. We've given him really a palliative course of therapy. He's improved, and we are currently still debating with the patient. He's a relatively recent patient. We've outlined the potential toxicity. Still a bit leery about giving Pembro to somebody with so much baseline respiratory insufficiency. Did not have interstitial lung disease, but he has fairly severe COPD. So any sort of respiratory compromise could just put him off the brink. He could end up in the ICU and on a ventilator. But he is right now leaning toward it. We've not yet started it.
So a couple questions about these kinds of situations. I assume that you can't make a diagnosis of cancer by liquid biopsy?
Not yet, but I think that day is coming. So if you have a high suspicion, for some reason the tumor is inaccessible, and you do a liquid biopsy and you find somatic mutations that are specific to cancer, for instance, EGFR mutation, you've got a de facto diagnosis. I mean, you've got a mass, you've got a liquid biopsy that shows molecular abnormalities that are specific for cancer. Obviously, if you see a BRCA1, that could be a germline mutation, but a somatic mutation could very well be specific for cancer. So the gold standard, of course, is still tissue or cytologic biopsy, but I foresee a time when we're going to substitute liquid biopsy. In small cell, you can actually find circulating tumor cells. So there you can truly see the cancer in the blood, an extensive stage disease. But this sort of person with squamous cell might have had a high TMB, but you know, could have had other reasons for that too.
What about KRAS? You see that in people without cancer?
I'm not 100% sure. I think you can see it in white cells, but generally not. But again, that's much more common in non-squamous. It's the most common mutation that exists, about 25 to 35%. But sadly, it's not yet actionable, although we're clearly trying. So I guess if somebody had cancer and was KRAS, had P53, had other mutations, you could make a circumstantial diagnosis, but I'd still want the tissue.
So I'm curious whether when you saw that PD-L1 level of 80%, you thought to yourself, if I'd known that in the beginning, maybe I would have tried it before even giving them radiation therapy?
Possibly, yes.
I mean, what's the chance you would actually have a good response with a PD-L1 level of 80%?
50% or higher, the response rates are 40 to 50%.
Yeah, interesting.
So pretty good chance, actually.
And same thing as we were talking about before. Of course, he was a heavy smoker, but if you had a very, very frail patient for other reasons or age or whatever who had, you know, EGFR mutation like this.
Oh, for sure. I would have given him a TKI. With the heavy smoking history, that wasn't likely.
Right.
And particularly with the histology. But in other scenarios, absolutely, he would have gotten osimertinib.
You mentioned before this issue of surgery in people with stage 3 disease. Let's hear about your 55-year-old man.
Sure. So I have a gentleman. It's actually sort of a composite patient. Former smoker, pack per day, 20 years. Right inguinal herniorrhaphy was found to have a right lower lobe mass, and that's typically how a curable or curative lung cancer is found. 5 centimeters on x-ray. Subsequent CAT scan, it looked larger. It was about 62 by 58 millimeters. The scan was otherwise negative. I had a transthoracic biopsy that showed adenocarcinoma. It was positive for TTF1 and P40. So right there, suspicion of a mixed histologic picture. PD-L1 was 30%. And the molecular and fusion panels were completely negative. So EGFR, ALK, all negative. PET scan showed intense uptake in the right lower lobe, but was negative in the mediastinum and hilum. And the brain MRI showed nonspecific vascular changes. There was no evidence of Mets. You could make an argument in the absence of any uptake on both CAT scan and PET to just go ahead and do the surgery and do a lymph node dissection at the time of surgery. But this was a big primary. This wasn't a 2 or 3 centimeter primary. This was 6 centimeters. So he actually underwent a bronchiebus, and lo and behold, at level 4 on the right ipsilateral to the tumor, same histology, a mixed adenosquamous. So he was no longer an N0, but an N2, a T3N2. Minimum 3A. The new staging system may actually be worse, but it's still somebody that you would approach with combined modality. And he was begun on concurrent chemo with etoposide platinum on a protocol with proton beam to 54 gray and then had surgical resection. And the final path showed a major pathologic response. The tumor itself was only about half the size, but less than 10% was viable. And major pathologic response is defined by at least 90% eradication of viable tumor. And probably as important or even more important, all the lymph nodes were negative. So he had no obvious residual nodal disease. So he was downstaged effectively to a T2AN0. And so the question always comes up in this sort of patient, do you give them additional adjuvant treatment? Should you give them more chemo? Remember, you only got two cycles of etoposide platinum. Do you put them on a regimen that would be specific for the squamous or non-squamous element? And is there a role for durvalumab in this situation? And the answer to all three questions is completely unknown.
So I'm kind of curious what you actually did, though.
This guy was beat up, was not eager to get more treatment, even though I was sort of leaning in favor of giving him more chemo, figuring that he really hadn't had a full course of adjuvant treatment. But there again, I have no proof. There was mostly adeno left, so I probably would have given him PEM platinum if he was at all willing. There's no proven role for durvalumab here. Now, you could extrapolate. You could argue, well, if locally advanced unresectable shows a survival advantage, it's got to show a survival advantage in resected disease. We have zero data. And with this degree of radiation in the pre-op setting, I think for me personally, it's a bridge too far.
Interesting. Are there situations in patients who have surgery where you would consider durvalumab?
Possibly in patients who did not have R0 resection. So where we knew that they had residual tumor, we gave them concurrent chemoradiation or gross residual, I'd probably go ahead with chemoradiation, then assume at best they're de facto stage 3 with residual tumor and give them durva at that point. If they've had a full resection, the highest nodes are negative, the margins are clear, I just don't quite have the comfort level yet.
So I'm kind of curious about the issue of neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors. I believe there are trials in the locally advanced disease that are incorporating that strategy. And I know there's data in the resectable situation because it was already published. And I think I talked to the Memorial people as they were doing, at least that was with one trial. And it's really interesting. So can you tell me what we know right now about neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors?
It's pretty exciting. The Memorial folks, and they weren't doing this on their own. They were doing it with other institutions, took resectable patients and gave them a few cycles of nivolumab up front. And here again, we see this sort of dyssynchrony between radiographic response and pathologic response. 40% or more had major pathologic responses, but the actual objective radiographic response was only about 19 or 20%. And some of these folks had hardly any viable tumor left. And this was just with a couple of doses of checkpoint inhibitor, no radiation, no chemo. Did not seem to exacerbate perioperative morbidity or affect resectability. And of course, it's attractive. You're giving systemic treatment up front. And the main reason these folks die is because of systemic metastasis. So you're starting the systemic therapy immediately and in an intact vasculature and healthier patients, so they're much more likely to tolerate the treatment. The downside is you're still delaying the definitive curative modality. Last I checked, surgery cures a lot more folks than any sort of adjuvant treatment or neoadjuvant treatment. More intriguingly, I think, is this trial from Spain by Provencia and colleagues, called the NADIM trial, N-A-D-I-M, and they actually added Nevo to standard chemo, to Pac Carbo regimen, and specifically targeted folks with 3A disease. So these are not stage 1s or 2s, but folks with a little bit more resectable 3A, but still locally advanced. And their response rates were astounding. The radiographic response rate was something like 70%. The major pathologic response rate, so greater than 90% eradication of tumor, less than 10% viability, was 80%. It was an astounding number. And the path CR rate was close to 60%. I've never seen data of that sort. Certainly with chemotherapy alone, the best data I've ever seen was an old study by Bedeker and colleagues back in the early aughts, looking at docetaxel and platinum, where the path CR rate was something like 20 or 25%. So it was literally double. So needless to say, there are multiple prospective phase 3 trials comparing chemo alone versus chemo plus a checkpoint inhibitor in the neoadjuvant setting. And I think those trials will probably unfurl themselves in the next 18, 24 months, maybe sooner if they're really positive.
Yeah, I don't know why, but for some reason, it's just really striking when you hear, I guess we've been associating checkpoint inhibitors with metastatic disease so much, it's kind of hard to get oriented. But if you think about it, first-line checkpoint inhibitors shrink tumors, and no doubt about it. I was interviewing Matt Hellman from Memorial. He had one of those patients on the trials, a woman in her 70s, resectable lesion, gave her two doses, I think it was Nevo. They went in there, they didn't find any viable tumors, like you said, some necrotic stuff. He didn't know what to do about adjuvant chemo. So he didn't give it to her, you know, but I guess you don't really know what to do in that situation.
If it was smaller than 3 or 4 centimeters, I probably wouldn't have given it either. But if the baseline tumor was bigger than 4 centimeters, I probably would have offered the adjuvant chemo. I don't feel confident enough just in the immunotherapy alone at this point to simply rely on that. What's really interesting is retrospectively, major pathologic response seems to correlate with better outcome, as you'd guess. And we certainly have seen this in breast cancer, but we've never proven it in lung cancer. It's all retrospective data. So these trials that are ongoing will either prove or disprove that notion.
I was mentioning before about bladder cancer, the 5 checkpoint inhibitors. They have neoadjuvant data there. And again, like I think 40, 50% path CR is like, that is bladder cancer. For that matter, bladder cancer, the other thing that's really wild about bladder, I don't know if you know about that, is they give it to people with non-invasive bladder who are resistant to BCG.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to cause benefit, which is really wild.
Comparatively speaking, I'd rather do a few cycles of a checkpoint inhibitor than get my bladder instilled repeatedly with BCG or mitomycin or other therapies.
Well, also in terms of, you know, neoadjuvant therapy, you know, getting cisplatinum, you know, some of the bladder regimens are pretty rough. And
For sure.
So if that works out, that's going to be a lot better for patients. I asked you if you had any patients who had primary radiation therapy to primary lung lesions. Just kind of curious how that plays out in your practice since we have a radiation oncology audience here. And maybe we can talk about your 70-year-old patient.
So this was a gentleman from West Philly, 30-pack-year smoker, multiple comorbidities, including COPD, diabetes, hypertension, CAD, again, a herniorrhaphy, found to have an incidental left lateral lobe mass on chest film. CAT scan confirmed a 3.5 centimeter lesion and also suggested perhaps some hilar adenopathy. At least the hilar node was enlarged. He had a core biopsy of the left lateral lobe mass that showed a mixed adenosquamous. Intriguingly, his KRAS mutation was positive. And because we had some suspicion that he had central nodal disease, he underwent a bronchiebus, and that was completely negative. So at least clinically, he was then T2N0.
What kind of shape was he in when you kind of look at him functionally?
Certainly good enough for radiation, not good enough for surgery. His FEV1 was really marginal. It was good enough to exist without oxygen, but he was the kind of patient where if you operated, you'd almost definitely end up on supplemental O2. And his remaining workup was completely negative. So this sort of patient now is standardly treated with stereotactic radiation. He completed in 5 fractions, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Monday, Wednesday. And 6 and 12 months, he's doing fine. Tumors decreased. He has the typical post-SRS radiation changes. Even in this setting, you can sometimes see clinical pneumonitis, although it's pretty rare. And we're just following him. I mean, he has so many other comorbidities that you'd be hard-pressed to put him through a major thoracic operation. By the same token, his tumor was smaller than 4 centimeters. There was no nodal involvement. In my mind, no indication for adjuvant chemo or adjuvant checkpoint inhibitors.
From your point of view, do you think there's generally efficacy equivalence between stereotactic and surgery?
My gut says yes. My brain says I don't know. Certainly, in unresectable patients, you have no choice. It's the standard approach. But in resectable or marginally resectable, that is not truly known. There have been a number of phase 3 efforts that have tried to compare surgical resection to stereotactic radiation. They've all failed. They lacked accrual. There is one ongoing effort, and I think it's very important. It's being done through the VA. It's called the VALOR trial. And I think Drew Mogdanaki is the principal investigator. And in the interest of full disclosure, I'm on the Data Safety Monitoring Committee that is trying to replicate that trial. And so far, it's accruing. The VA population tends to be different from the general public. Remains to be seen if it's going to accrue adequately, but it's definitely ahead of the other trials. And I personally think it's an extraordinarily important question, particularly in these folks with marginal resectability.
Any other comments specifically relevant to radiation oncologists? Any new developments in lung cancer that you think are particularly relevant to radiation oncologists? Any suggestions for improvement based on interactions, things you don't like they do, if there's any?
Well, I think most of them have learned their lessons, as have the medical oncologists, that you don't tackle any of these patients without a multidisciplinary tumor board. Anybody who's going to be even considered for combined modality, you've got to sit down a priori with the medical oncologist, with the surgeons, if you think there's any potential role for surgery, and frankly, with the pulmonologist. We have interventional pulmonologists at our institution are critical to making sure these patients get through their treatment. And that sort of multidisciplinary approach is super critical. Everett Vokes has said this, and I will reiterate it, the best form of radiation in locally advanced disease is chemo radiation. Combined modality therapy is still the standard. And now, of course, we have the prospect of trimodality if we consider checkpoint inhibitors yet another modality. I think we've got to be sensitized to the notion of continued close surveillance after the chemo radiation and make sure horrible side effects aren't occurring, particularly pneumonitis. So far, the clinical trials say the rates aren't very high. Personally, my experience with pneumonitis is a little bit higher than I've seen objectively in the clinical trials. And again, I'm probably treating a broader population, some of whom might not have been candidates for those trials. And then finally, I think we have to abandon this notion that more is better. Certainly the RTOG-0617 showed with conventional radiation that 74 gray not only was no better than 60 gray, it was worse. We had higher toxicities and lower survival. So we've got to be very careful and deliberative about how the radiation's given. And it really does require a major therapeutic alliance with the other modalities and, of course, with their physicists. And I think for the most part, radiation oncologists who are used to treating locally advanced non-small cell have all this down pat, but those lessons need to keep going.
You mentioned that trial looking at higher dose. I actually asked Dr. Rimner about it because I hadn't heard about it lately. And I was asking him, I'll ask you, if you have any hypotheses about why patients did worse with higher dose. Did they have more toxicity or was it something else?
Some more toxicity. I think the V5 with the level of radiation that went to the heart was higher, and there may have been some delayed cardiopulmonary toxicities that may or may not have been attributed to the combined modality. And there were also some inadvertent imbalances in the baseline demographics of the study that actually favored the lower dose arm. But the bottom line is just an empiric escalation in the dose does not benefit patients. It seems to cause more mayhem than benefit. But a full analysis still needs to be done. I think one of the other theories was that perhaps they had a rougher time getting all the chemo in, although I'm not sure that's panned out.
Anything else you want to add to what you said today?
Just imperative we get folks on clinical trials, and the checkpoint inhibitors are here to stay. I still want to see an analysis based on PET imaging. I've yet to see that. And importantly, in this regard with the PACIFIC trial, we need to see the patterns of recurrence. We've seen the sites, but if there's a lung recurrence, is that happening in field? Is it regional? Is it out of the field? I don't have any sense of that, and I think that may help determine how we go forward with future treatments.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio program on lingering controversies and emerging therapeutic strategies for patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer.